Now, last time we introduced the various types of transport, and I'm going to summarize those. And what I'm going to draw is from last time's handout, and it's fairly short. If you don't have it, you don't really need to bring it out, but it's from a C of last time. And then we're going to go over how you tell all these various types of transport apart. And you largely do that by measuring transport, and we'll explain how that's done. And then we're going to go through each of the cases we're going to talk about, the types of transport, and then at the end we'll do some models. And next time we'll wrap up anything we don't get to, and then we're going to explain how you use all these kinds of transport to get the glucose you eat from the lumen of your intestine all the way to your body cells. But we want to talk first about the types of transport. Now, of course, we're talking here entirely about transport of small molecules. We'll get to large molecules later, and we're talking about transport across membranes. So we said when you talk about transport, you can divide it into five categories. We said that category one, or case one, is you don't need any protein. That is, simple diffusion. And case two is you need a protein. Not case two, but everything else is you need a protein. And then that's subdivided into the type of protein that it is. Whether it's a channel, which is case two, or whether it's a transporter protein, such as a carrier, a pump, etc. And as we'll see, the big difference is that channel proteins are thought, once they're in place, to be relatively inert, but the transport proteins have to change conformation to move the substrate from one side to the other. Because what we're looking at here is if this is a membrane, and let's say this is outside and this is in, we're looking at transporting X from one side to the other. Now, I've arbitrarily written out to in, but it could be in to out. Sometimes things flow into cells, sometimes things flow out, and some things flow in either direction, depending on the circumstances. So this is what we're looking at, getting X across the membrane. And if it uses one of these transport proteins, there are two possibilities. One is the transport is passive, and one that it's active. Now, what we mean by passive transport is that it is the concentration of X, which provides difference on the two sides. It's the difference in concentration of X, or the gradient of X, that provides the energy to drive X. And that's called passive transport, where X goes down its gradient. And this is usually called facilitated diffusion or carrier-mediated transport, as we explained last time. Now, active transport means that X is actually going up its gradient. It's being pushed against its gradient by an external source of energy. And that energy is either directly from ATP, in which case this is called primary or direct active transport, or the energy comes from somewhere else, usually a gradient of cations. And this is called secondary or indirect active transport. Both of these cases, X is being pushed up as gradient, but the question is whether ATP is doing it directly or whether ATP set up something else and the something else is actually pushing X. So, we want to look at these and see what the difference is. If we have a particular case, for example, how are we going to know what we're looking at? Which kind of transport is it? So we have to measure transport experimentally. Now, how are you going to do that? The usual method for doing that is you have a solution with some concentration of X in it, which is called the concentration outside or X outside or whatever. So you have some concentration of X in here. And then you have something surrounded by a membrane. It can be a cell, it can be a vesicle, or in the simplest case, it is a red blood cell ghost. Because you remember what a red blood cell ghost is basically just a sealed membrane. It's like a balloon. So this is a ghost, but it could be any kind of membrane enclosed compartment. And what you do is you wait with time and you measure how much X is in inside at various time points. Now, the way you set it up usually is that the concentration inside to start is zero. That is, there's solution in here, but it has no X in it. That's the usual setup. And then what you do is, after a period of time, you take this solution, you centrifuge it, and pour off the solution. So that's the outside. And you're left with the ghosts, and then you break them open and measure how much X is inside. So what you're getting is, if you now look at today's handout on the top, you're looking at that series, a curve. There are six curves here, six graphs, and the three on the top were arranged, gotten this exactly the same way. All three on the top are what I call curve one. That every last one of them has the same axis. What you're measuring is the concentration inside as a function of time. And you notice that all of those curves have the same shape. They're all hyperbolic. They look something like this. So what this means is more stuff inside, more stuff inside, more stuff inside. But after a while, you don't keep increasing the stuff inside. Now, why not? Because material goes in and material goes out. And at this point, the two are equal. The rate at which things are going in and the rate at which things are going out is balanced. And as a result, you have a constant concentration, or you have a plateau of the curve, which means that the concentration inside has reached its maximal equilibrium value. Now, what do you learn from doing this? Does this distinguish any of those cases? Now, you might notice that all three cases on the top of your handout look more or less the same. They have the same shape. But the question is, when you reach this plateau, how does the concentration inside relate to the concentration outside? If you have any kind, if X is going down its gradient, in this case, if you started with high X outside and no X inside, then X is going to go in, and once the concentration gets high, some of it is going to go out, and you're going to reach equilibrium when the X inside concentration equals the X outside. So in passive transport, things move until the concentration of X is the same everywhere. So for which cases, let's see, for 1, 2, and 3, all of these are passive. All of these are X going down its gradient. So in cases 1, 2, and 3, the inside concentration will equal the outside concentration. Now, usually the way you do this, the concentration you end up with is essentially the concentration you started with. Because you started with a lot outside and a very small volume inside. And so even though material moves into the inside, the overall concentration is very close to what you started with. But whatever it is, you end up with inside equals outside. And you notice that your first two curves look like that. But now, is it always like that? What if you have active transport? That means energy is being expended to push X in. And you can actually push X in until the concentration is higher inside than it is outside. And you notice that's what the last of the three curves looks like. Same shape, but you notice that this is the concentration outside and this is the concentration inside. The concentration inside is greater than the concentration outside. Now, the concentration still plateaus inside. You don't just keep shoving it in forever. Now, why don't you keep shoving it in forever? Think of a pump. A pump pumps the water up until the head of water, the pressure of the water up, gets so high that the pump can't push anymore against it. So there's some limit. The amount of energy supplied is enough to raise the concentration to some point, and then it can't push anymore. And so you reach a plateau, but at that plateau, the push in is sufficient so that you have a higher concentration inside than outside. Now, this assumes you're moving X from out to in. If you were moving X from in to out, it would be reversed. But it's higher on one side than it is on the other. It's not equal on both sides anymore. So doing this kind of measurement, measuring the concentration inside with time, what does that tell you? It tells you whether you're dealing with active transport or whether you're dealing with passive transport, because in one case, at the plateau, concentration outside and inside are equal. And at the other case, they're not. Now, this is the top three curves, but you may notice there are three more. What are those? That's what I call curve two. Now, what's the difference? Well, to see that, let's ask a question. Suppose I do this experiment. I start out with some concentration outside. I have zero starting concentration inside. And with increasing time, I measure how much is inside, and I get one of these curves. Now let's suppose I do it again, but the second time, I increase the concentration outside. So if it was, say, 5 millimolar, now it's 10 millimolar. Whatever it was, it's now higher. And I do the same experiment all over again. So the question is, what will be the same or different? Will I get exactly the same curve? Or will the slope be the same or different? And what about the level at which I plateau? Will that be the same or different? So I want you to think about this for a minute, discuss it with the person or people next to you, and decide, if I start with a higher concentration outside, what does the curve look like? Any question? Oh, no. She's talking. Now, I'm going to warn you, I think I'm going to call on somebody at the end of this one. Take a vote again, and I'm not going to make you close your eyes, but try and keep it honest. If you have more stuff outside, nobody thinks the slope of that curve is going to be lower. So the question is, if you have more stuff outside is the slope going to be higher or steeper? Or is it going to stay the same? So how many people think it'll be steeper? How many people think it will stay the same? Now, if you don't mind, could I ask somebody to defend why it might stay the same? Why?
There's a maximum concentration the cell can handle, and it's not really going to matter whether the concentration outside is bigger. There's just the maximum amount that the cell can handle.
So he's suggesting that at some point, if we have a carrier protein involved here, at some, and we didn't say that, but let's assume we do, that we have a carrier protein. If we have a transporter type protein, there's some point at which it's working as fast as it possibly can. So if I up the concentration of X, it ain't going to make any difference. The enzyme is working maximal. It's at Vmax, so to speak. It's shoveling as fast as it can, and more X won't make any difference. But is that always the case? A lot. Most of you said X will go up. Because if you haven't yet reached the maximum level, then in fact, if the enzyme is not working, or carrier is not working at capacity, then if you add more X, the enzyme will catalyze, taking in more per minute. So, what should the curve look like? This is what curve 2 is. Curve 2 is if you measure not the concentration inside, but the rate of uptake, or flux, otherwise known as this slope. The initial rate of this curve, the slope of this curve, measures the rate of uptake. So what we're saying is, we measure this rate with some concentration of X, then we measure this rate again with another concentration of X, and we measure this rate again. And again, with a carrier, you're going to get something like this. Now you may notice, so we're measuring rate, not as a function of time, but as a rate of the X, the concentration outside, or the X added. The more X you add, the faster transport goes up to a point. Does this look like anything you have ever seen before? This is actually very similar to a V versus S curve for an enzyme. So many people say that the transport protein is sort of acting like an enzyme, but the reaction it's catalyzing is that reaction up there. It's catalyzing X on this side to X on that side. It is picking X up and moving it over. And it can work only so fast. And so whenever you have a transport type protein, you get a curve like this. Now, you notice that although there are three curves written there, one of them looks different. What if you have no carrier protein? What if it's case one? Then the more X you add, the faster it diffuses, and you just get that curve shown on the left, which I want to draw over here, curve two, which looks like this. The way people say this is a pattern of flux versus outside concentration. Transport does not saturate in this case. It just goes faster and faster and faster and faster because there is no carrier with a maximal capacity. Now, the one case that's worth talking about is two. For channels, does it look like this? Or does it look like this? Well, the real answer is that for channels, it looks sort of like this. Meaning that for a channel, under the usual concentrations, both in cells and in test tubes, if for channels, they generally don't saturate. That things just go faster as you add more. It takes an enormous amount of stuff to saturate a channel. If things are waiting to go through a channel, they don't really have to wait. There's no line. And one of the great things that people are interested in is, how can things move through channels so fast with no waiting? How come the channel has an extremely large capacity? And this is a question to which we will return. Now, I want to say, if you're trying to follow this in the lecture notes, that I am going to go over everything that's in there, more or less in the order it's there, not exactly. But that the notes are very repetitive, because everything is laid out at least twice. And that's to help you when you go study, but I'm not going to say it all. Maybe I'll say it twice, but I'm not going to say it three or four times the way it is in the notes. So almost everything is explained, and then it's summarized, and it's explained, and then it's summarized. So from curve one, we figure out whether we're dealing with active versus passive transport. What do we figure out from curve two? Well, if we get this kind of curve, which case are we dealing with, or cases? We're dealing actually with one or two. But if we get the hyperbolic curve, we're dealing with three, four, or five. So I think what I want to do now is leave the curves for the moment and look at it from a different angle. So far we've been saying, okay, you do get curve type 1, you get curve type 2, what do they tell you, what's the general principle? Now I want to go back and do it the other way. If we look at our cases 1 through 5, and we measure, what do you learn from examining cases 1 through 5? But before I do that, let me ask if there are questions before I go on. Yeah?
For active transport, can the plateau not be lower than the outside concentration?
For the plateau, could the curve be lower than the outside concentration? Well, if the active transport is pushing things out, then it will be higher outside than inside. If the active transport is pushing things in, it will be higher inside than outside. So it depends whether you mean by this the outside concentration or the starting concentration. Whether it will be lower or higher. Other questions? Okay, so let's sort of see how this applies. And let's look at case one first. So what are we talking about in case one? We're talking about simple diffusion across a membrane. And we've already explained that if you measure in the case of simple diffusion, if you look at the concentration inside as a function of time, it's just going to give you a hyperbolic curve, and it's going to plateau at inside equals outside. Because that's true for any case of passive transport, cases 1, 2, or 3. And however, when you look at curve 2, at the flux as a function of concentration added, you notice that you just get increasing, for simple diffusion, the more stuff you add, the faster it goes in. Because the gradient of stuff is the only thing driving this. It's the only factor in here. There is no enzyme or machine or protein that has to do anything. So just the more you add, the faster it goes in. Now, one way of looking at this is in terms of K equilibrium and delta G. Now, you may have thought you've heard the last of delta G and delta G zero. But in fact, we spent all that time talking about it last semester, so it's worth talking about this in those terms again. For passive transport, delta G zero equals zero. That means the equilibrium constant is one, which means that at equilibrium, the concentration on the two sides is equal. Which is just another way of saying when the gradient runs down, you're going to have equal amounts of stuff on both sides. But if the delta G0 is zero, what is the delta G? Remember, the delta G equals the delta G zero plus a factor for real concentrations. If the delta G zero is zero, it means what the actual delta G is depends entirely on the concentration of X. If the concentration of X is higher on this side, then delta G is negative that way. If the concentration of X is higher on this side, then the delta G is negative that way. So the delta G then entirely depends on the concentrations. And this reaction is totally reversible. You can use it to move X this way, or you can use it to move X out. Doesn't make any difference. Just depends which side has more X. And as we'll see, this argument applies to cases 1, 2, and 3, to all cases of passive transport. Now, we already mentioned it, but just to bring it up again, what good is all this? What good is simple diffusion across a membrane? When does it ever matter? And we mentioned last time that this is important for gases, both oxygen and CO2, and then also nitric oxide, which acts as a signal molecule. Gases can simply diffuse across membranes, no problem. And so can lipid-soluble molecules. And as we mentioned last time, some of the hormones, the steroid hormones and several others which act like steroids, all lipid-soluble hormones can diffuse across membranes. And therefore, their receptors don't have to be on the surface. The receptor can be inside the cell. So these are the things that we're going to meet up again, examples of things that move across membranes and are physiologically important, but whose transport requires no protein. Well, that takes care of case one. And I want to skip two for now, in part because it was discovered last, so explain it last. And I want to talk about case three. How is case three different than case one? Well, whether we have a protein transporter involved or not, we have the same old reaction. We're worried about X going in, or as the case may be, X going out. But the difference is we have a catalyst for this. We have a transport protein, or even some people consider it an enzyme. The carrier or transporter in this case is sometimes called a permease, implying that it acts like an enzyme, which it does. Except the reaction that it catalyzes is X on one side to X on the other. And you can measure its Km and its Vmax, just like you can for any enzyme. Now, if you have a carrier like this, what will the curves look like? I think we've already said, and you can look at the middle two curves on your handout, that they're both going to be hyperbolic. Now, remember, if you measure inside with time, this is passive transport, so at equilibrium, in equals out. If you measure rate of uptake with stuff added, the rate is going to actually plateau when your carrier or permease is working as fast as it can. Now, if a transporter is like an enzyme, it means it's going to be extremely specific. Or we could say it another way, one of the reasons these are compared to enzymes is that they are very specific. Each transport protein has a specific shape, binds a specific X, and transports only one or a small number of similar type molecules. So there's a lot of specificity in here. Now, the energy situation is exactly the same as for simple diffusion. But I think this might make more sense if we consider a real example. There is another family of proteins, we're going to meet many, which are called glutes. And this stands for, the GL stands for, GLU stands for glucose, and the T stands for transporter. These proteins are permeases that catalyze glucose transport. And This is a case of passive transport. Glucose always goes down its gradient. But in some cases, that means it enters cells, and in some cases, that means that it exits. Because it depends on the concentration of glucose, whether there's more inside or more outside. Now, this is a family of proteins, so there are a bunch of similar ones, and they're called GLUT1, GLUT2, etc. The ones that you'll hear about mostly are 1, 2, and 4. One is found in red blood cells. It's what red blood cells use to take up glucose for their energy needs. GLUT2 is found in liver and in many other places. And one of the things that's so interesting about GLUT2 in liver is that it can be used either to transport glucose in or to transport glucose out. Liver is one of the few, if not the only, tissues that is able to release glucose to the blood. Most tissues cannot. And when it releases glucose in the blood, it uses GLUT2. And when it picks up glucose from the blood, it uses GLUT2. It just depends on the concentration of glucose, which way the glucose goes. Now, GLUT4 is found in adipose tissue and in muscle, among other things. And it's an extremely important transporter for reasons that we'll explain. Because what I want to talk about next is how these things are regulated. It turns out that of all the glutes, GLUT4 is regulated in a unique way, which has important physiological implications. So I want to talk now about regulation. Now, I'm not talking about regulating or controlling the amount of protein that's made. We'll talk about that later. But I'm saying if you have a fixed amount of protein, like GLUT1 or GLUT2 or GLUT4 or anything, in many cases, you can control or regulate the activity of that protein. You can turn it up or turn it down. Now, how do you do that? What's the case we've already talked about? We talked about it in bacteria, but it's the same everywhere. Is there a brave soul who remembers some kind of way you can change the activity of a protein?
Inhibition.
What did you say?
Inhibition.
Inhibition, what kind? Allosteric inhibition. And there's also allosteric activation. What this means is that you have a protein. It's already there. And then it binds something else, usually a small molecule, but could be another big one. It binds to something else, and that binding changes its conformation a little bit and makes it work better or worse. That's what we mean by allosteric inhibition or activation. We talked about feedback inhibition as an example of this, where the end product comes back, binds to the first enzyme in the pathway, and causes it to change conformation and slow down. So any protein that has a binding site for an effector, for a signal molecule, can in fact change conformation and be allosterically inhibited or activated. It doesn't have to be a transporter to be regulated in this way. I'm going to talk about three kinds of regulation, and the first two, of which this is one, apply to all enzymes and proteins in the cell. But the third mechanism applies only to transport proteins. Now, the second method, which we really haven't talked about very much, is covalent modification. Now, in the case of allosteric effects, the protein binds non-covalently to something else, and that changes its conformation a bit, and that changes how well it works. In the case of covalent modification, the protein is actually altered covalently. And the usual, but not only, way is by the addition or the loss of phosphates. There are other ways as well, other modifications. Well, if I'm going to add phosphate to a protein, that means I'm going to add it to the side chains of the appropriate amino acids. I'm going to make a covalent bond. What do I need? Energy. What else? Enzymes. The usual magic two words. I'm going to need enzymes and energy. And in this case, the energy is usually, but not always, in the form of ATP. So the way you usually modify enzymes, the way you add phosphate, is by using a kinase, which catalyzes phosphorylation. Now, a kinase catalyzes a reaction, which is X, whatever that happens to be, plus ATP, and a phosphate from ATP is added to X, and then you're left with ADP. Now, what we're saying in this case, X can be a protein. You can add a phosphate to a protein, and this changes its conformation and makes it work better or worse. Sometimes this inhibits, sometimes this activates. So here you're not using the energy of ATP to drive some reaction or pathway. You're using it for regulation, to change conformation and regulation. Now, just as allosteric effect inhibition or activation is reversible, so is covalent modification. Reversible? Covalent bonds? If I'm going to reverse this, I'm going to have to knock the phosphate off. I'm going to have to hydrolyze this bond. So what's that going to take? That's going to take another enzyme. Now, it's not going to take energy because it's a downhill reaction with a negative delta G. But it's going to take an enzyme. So a different enzyme, which is called a phosphatase, comes into play. Phosphatases take X with a phosphate. Again, different ones use different X's. And they hydrolyze this bond. They catalyze its hydrolysis. So you get plain X, really XOH, and ADP. I don't mean ADP, I mean phosphate. You get X plus inorganic phosphate or phosphate floating in solution. And this reaction has a negative delta G. This reaction has a negative delta G because of the ATP involved. So both of these are favorable. So if the enzyme is there and does its thing, they will go. Now, what this means is you can have a protein lying around in the cell. And if the kinases are active, it will be phosphorylated. If the appropriate phosphatases are active, it will not. And one of these forms is often active and one is inactive. So, by triggering either phosphorylation or dephosphorylation, one activates or inactivates the enzyme. So let's say it another way. Are these reactions reversible? Well, there any reaction is micro-reversible. But in a cell, are you going to see this going either way? And the answer is no. Inside a cell, dephosphorylation always goes to the right, if it goes at all. Inside a cell, kinases always go to the right, if they go at all. So these reactions, when they take place, are almost always in the same direction. But from the enzyme's point of view, putting on the phosphate and taking off the phosphate is reversible because one enzyme can put it on, one enzyme can take it off. Now, just to be sure, are these two enzymes the reverse of each other, these two reactions? Notice they're not. The reverse of this reaction, phosphorylation, would be to take the phosphate, put it back on ADP, and give us back ATP, and we don't do that. So from the enzyme's point of view, it's reversible, but each individual reaction is not. Now, many enzymes and proteins in the cell are activated and deactivated in this way. It's much more important in eukaryotes than in prokaryotes, and we're going to meet many variants on this scheme. All right, but what's the third method of modification of regulation, which is only applicable to transport proteins or membrane proteins in general? This has to do with changing the location of where the protein is. Most of the proteins in a cell are soluble, and they'll work wherever they are. Conditions may be better in one place than another, but they're soluble and they do their thing. But consider a protein that's in a membrane, and for this case, we'll stick to transporters. Here are two situations. In this one, the transport protein is sitting in the membrane. And in this case, the transport protein is still in a membrane, but that membrane is that of a vesicle inside the cell. So this is the outside, this is the cytoplasm inside. In which of these cases can the protein assist in transport? Well, here, the protein is present. The door, so to speak, is there. And material can move in or out depending on concentration. So here we can have carrier-mediated transport. The transport protein is in the membrane and can help things move across. But what about this membrane? There's no door in this membrane. This cell membrane has no way to move things across it. The protein has been moved or is in an inactive position, and it can't do anything. Now, this is a membrane protein, so it's always embedded in a membrane, but it's in the wrong place. If material were in the cell, it could use this transport protein to get in or out of the vesicle. But if the material is outside the cell, it cannot use this protein to get in or to get out. Now, there are some proteins whose activity is regulated because once the protein is made, you can go from one to the other. The way these membrane proteins are made that belong on the surface of the cell is the protein is made on the ER, on the rough ER, in ways we will establish later, and inserted into the ER, and then a vesicle buds off the ER. So when the protein is found in the cell, it's going to be in a membrane vesicle, like this. But in order for this protein to work, the vesicle has to go and fuse with the cell membrane. So I'm going to draw it this way. Here's our vesicle coming up to the cell membrane. So if now we open it here, then we're going to have, well, I'll draw it over here. Here, if we fuse these two membranes, now if all I do is straighten this out, my protein will now be in the membrane. I will have this case. Now, this process is reversible. So just as the vesicle can fuse with the membrane and put the protein in the membrane so it can be used for transport, so the protein can invaginate, bud off a vesicle, and now remove that protein from the membrane. Now, GLUT4 is regulated in this way. GLUT1 and 2 are not. With GLUT1 and 2, once you put them into the membrane, they stay in the membrane. That's it. But GLUT4 is a transporter which is responsive to insulin. Only certain cell types make it. But those cell types hold their GLUT4 over here inside until the insulin comes along. When the insulin comes along, then they move their GLUT4 up to the membrane so it looks like this. So we could say plus insulin, minus insulin. Now, what happens then if there's no insulin? The transporter is inside where it can't be used. Glucose cannot get into the cell, and you have a problem. Well, sometimes you're not supposed to take any glucose, so that's fine. But if you're there's a lot of glucose around, you can't take it up. Now, this business of one way of thinking about this is the transport protein is acting like a door. Carrier-mediated transport is sort of like a revolving door. It can be used in either direction, depending on the press of people. If you take the door out of the wall, you can't get through. No revolving door, I can't get across a solid wall. Now, how many of you have ever seen faulty towers? If you've never seen faulty towers, you're missing something. This is a British sitcom, which is extremely funny and totally outrageous. And it's about this guy who runs this absolutely hopeless hotel where everything always goes wrong. And there is an extremely dumb waiter. And there is a scene in which they remodel the hotel and they move the door. And Manuel, the waiter, takes a whole big platter of dirty dishes and he marches up to where the door used to be. What do you think happens? Crash, bang, mess. Because there's no door. And I always think of that because here what you do is there's no door. No insulin, no door. Okay? Now the difference here is it's reversible. Unlike with faulty towers, you sort of have the door on wheels and you can wheel it up and you can wheel it back. That's a little different from a real remodeling situation. Okay, so any protein which functions by being in the membrane can be regulated in this way, but only proteins that belong in the membrane. Now, the GLUT4 protein is one very famous example of this, and another one which I want to mention are the proteins called aquaporins. These are actually channel proteins, primarily but not always in the kidney. And they are channels for water, as the aqua may imply. Now, most membranes are a little bit permeable to water. That is, water can get through the membrane, but only a little bit. But when you put one of these channels or doors into the membrane, then water can very easily get in or out. And just as insulin controls whether GLUT4 is in the membrane or not, so the hormone ADH, or antidiuretic hormone, also known as vasopressin, controls whether the aquaporins are in the kidney membranes, the membrane of the cells of the kidney or not. And we'll explain the kidney in some detail later. But the basic idea is, if you put these proteins into the membrane, then water can go back and forth. And if you take these out of the membrane, water is stuck. It cannot get out or in to the cells. And what this regulates is, of the water that is in the pre-urine, how much of it passes through cells and back into the body, and how much of it just leaves, is controlled by these aquaporins, the location of these aquaporins. Now, we have talked about two kinds of passive transport, one in three, and alluded a little to two, which we'll come back. But now I want to talk about active transport. So before I talk about active transport, let me ask what questions there are about passive transport.
Can anchored proteins be unanchored and moved?
Can anchored proteins be unanchored and moved? Yes. Or their anchors can move. Yeah?
I just want to know, with the ADH, did you say that the presence of the ADH causes the aquaporins to be, to allow the water through? And reverse?
Which way does it go? Well, we'll get to that when we get to the kidney, but it's anti-diuretic hormone, meaning that it prevents water from leaving. So that means the water stays. So that means the water has to go into the pores and into your body instead of going out. But we'll go through all that when we get to it. Yeah?
With type 2 diabetes, what's going on with the...
Okay, type 1 diabetes is when you don't have insulin. Type 2 diabetes is when you don't respond to it properly. And there are multiple steps in the operation that can go wrong. Insulin response to insulin requires a very complicated signaling pathway. And any one part of it can be wrong.
Does this mean that there's also a signaling protein involved in GLUT4 that knows whether insulin is on the outside?
The question of how do you know whether there's insulin there or not? Yes, there is another protein, which is a receptor for insulin, which triggers a bunch of other things. And when we talk about signaling, we'll talk about some of that. We probably will not talk about the specific pathway in insulin because it's unique to insulin and complicated. Was there a question back there?
Is there any kind of need for any regulation with the vesicles at all? Because there are membranes stuck in the membrane of the vesicle.
The point of is this in itself regulated? What's regulated is the fusion or removal is this process. What's regulated is where this goes. There was a question over back there? Yeah. What is this type of regulation called? I don't think it has a short, snappy name. Okay? But it's by insertion and removal from the membrane. Now, there was one more question, then we're going to go on. Yeah?
Let's ask a little bit more about the lipid-soluble hormones.
Say that again?
The lipid-soluble hormones.
What about them?
If they can diffuse through all the cells, does that just mean there's where they're needed, there are the receptors for them? Because otherwise, we can just be able to...
Her question is about steroid hormones. If they can go anywhere, how come they only work in certain cells and not in others? And that's the answer is because only some cells have receptors and some don't. Okay, so now let's leave this and go on to active transport, cases 4 and 5. Now, what's the same here is that actually if you were, and you can see this from looking at your handout, that curve number 2 is the same whether you have active for cases 3, 4, and 5. Because what this says is the rate at which the protein can move its target substance is limited. And that's true whether you're talking about active or passive transport. All three cases here, you have a protein that changes conformation, and when it's working as fast as it can, adding more X doesn't make any difference. So curve 2 is actually the same. But as we've indicated, curve 1 is different, because if you have active transport, then at equilibrium, you don't have to have equal concentrations of X on the two sides of the membrane. You can have more on one side or the other. Now, if we come back to our delta G argument, that means that for active transport, delta G0 is not zero. Now, how does active transport work? If we just consider this reaction, now, we could be doing X out to X in, or we could be doing X in to X out, but let's just stick with this one. In primary active transport, this is coupled to ATP hydrolysis. Now, the X part may be uphill, but the whole thing is negative delta G0. If we're talking about secondary or indirect active transport, then we're talking of usually about some other downhill delta G negative process being coupled to the X movement, and it's usually a gradient. So an example would be sodium high on one side goes to sodium low on the other. So sodium, or it could be protons, it could be a lot of things, usually it's a cation runs down its gradient, and that energy is used to push X. So X is going against its gradient, but the other stuff is going down its gradient. And as we explained last time, this can be either antiport or it can be symport. These two can be going in the same direction or opposite. Now, in both of these cases, overall, when you consider both halves, delta G0 is not zero anymore. Delta G0, in fact, is usually very negative. X out to in is uphill, delta G0 positive, but the other half is very negative. Now, the importance of this is if a reaction, if the delta G0 is very, very negative, it means no matter what concentrations you have, it almost always goes that way. So inside living cells, This reactions almost always go to the right. Now, secondary active transport is sometimes also called indirect, because in order for it to work, where do we get the sodium gradient from? That came from some primary active transport involving ATP. But once we've set up the sodium gradient, do we need any ATP to run this part? What if we stopped making ATP? What would happen? Well, if we don't have any ATP around, the top one will obviously stop right away. But if we don't have any ATP around, what will happen to the bottom? Will it go on forever?
No.
No, it won't. But it won't stop right away. Because until the sodium gradient runs down, number two will run just fine. Now, in a cell, what is going on? Sodium run down at gradient, that pushes X. Then ATP moves the sodium back up again. And so we have a constant difference in sodium. If you stop ATP production, eventually the sodium gradient will run down, it will not be replenished, and this process will stop. Now, what are examples of these? We mentioned them actually last time, but the most famous examples of this, for the most famous example of primary, is the sodium-potassium pump. Now, this is actually a case where you're moving two things courtesy of the energy of ATP. ATP is used to move potassium into cells and sodium out. So this is a case of antiport, but the ATP all stays inside. But the two ions that move, move in opposite directions. The most famous case of secondary is probably sodium glucose co-transport. Sodium runs down its gradient, and that drives glucose actually in the same direction. So in this case, the sodium and the X go in the same direction, and so that's considered symport. Now remember we said that the glute proteins, which mediate passive transport, are responsible for most glucose getting into cells. But there are exceptions. In some cases, glucose gets into cells. It goes against its gradient, courtesy sodium. And that's actually how the glucose gets into the cells lining your gut. It's pushed by sodium, and then after that, it's all passive. And we'll explain how you put that together next time. Now, I have a question. Suppose instead of blocking ATP production, you block the pump, the sodium-potassium pump. Now, will that affect primary transport of anything else? No, except in the case that you might have more ATP lying around because you aren't using a lot of it on the pump. But basically, no. It's not going to have any effect on others. Is it going to have any effect on this? Is it going to have an immediate effect? No, it's not. Because you've already got a high sodium. So this will run for a while. But without the pump, eventually the sodium will run down. Now, what if you blocked ATP production? Whether you block ATP production, if you block ATP production, you'd quite quickly stop this one, but not that one. But from the point of view of secondary active transport, whether you block ATP production or whether you block the pump has the same effect. Basically, you can't remake your sodium gradient once it runs down. So you can see here that by blocking various stages, various processes, you can actually tell these two apart. Because they are dependent, one is dependent immediately on a gradient, the other is dependent immediately on ATP. And there are a bunch of problems that you get to do about telling these apart. Now, I want to come back briefly and talk about channels. We mentioned earlier that channels were discovered last. And channels have the odd property that they do not saturate at physiological conditions. On the other hand, channels are very fast. And they are both fast. They don't saturate, but they are specific. Now, if they're fast and don't saturate, the implication is they just sort of sit there with an open door and who wants to go through goes through. But the fact that they're specific means that they must in some way have a shape that allows certain things to go through and not others. And one of the most interesting ones, which has been figured out, and you can read more about it in your books or there's a link in your notes, is that there is a potassium channel. Now, the thing that it allows potassium and not sodium, but sodium is smaller than potassium. So the question of how does it pull that off is related to the idea that the hydrated sodium is larger than potassium. And so potassium is able to lose its waters and sneak through, and sodium cannot. So this is explained in your notes a little bit, and there's a link to the Nobel Prize awarded to the person who figured this out. So in some ways, channels act like, once the channel's there, you have simple diffusion through it. But in other ways, since they are specific, it doesn't seem right to call the two of these both facilitated diffusion. Both of them are facilitated because you need a protein. Both of them are diffusion because it's down a gradient. But clearly the mechanism is different. This one is like a fancy door, just a plain open door. And this one is more like a revolving door, something that has to change conformation. And so usually facilitated diffusion refers to carrier-mediated, but people, to be careful, talk about channel-mediated transport and carrier-mediated, and we'll try and be careful. But it depends on context which terms are used here. Now, there's something very important to talk about with regard to channels. Most channels are gated. Now, we already talked about gap junctions. Gap junctions are a little different than channels because they're bigger, but it's the same sort of idea, that you have a sort of hole in the membrane and things can go through it. But as with gap junctions, most channels are gated, meaning that they can be opened or closed in response to signals. Now, unlike with allosteric proteins, it doesn't seem likely that they're part open or part closed. Each channel is either open or closed, but the proportion that's open or closed is regulated. Now, what gates channels? What gives the signal to open or close it? There are three common kinds. They're called ligand-gated, voltage-gated, and mechanically gated. Now, what they mean is, ligand-gated channels open or close in response to a chemical substance, aka ligand or ligand. So when the right chemical comes along, it binds and it either opens or closes. And these are very important in that neurotransmitters, for example, and many hormones have this effect, that they close or open channels. Now, voltage-gated channels open in response to changes in voltage or charge differences across the membrane. And they're very important in muscle and nerve conduction. In muscle and nerve, often a chemically gated channel is opened, which then leads to big difference or closed, which leads to big differences in charge, which triggers voltage gated channel. So we'll talk about that in detail. Now, mechanically gated channels are very important in some of your senses. They're very important in hearing and in touch and also in balance. And that actual physical pushing of something against the receptor triggers the opening or closing of the channel. And we'll talk about them a little bit. Now, there's one other feature of channels which is really important, and that is that many channels are ion channels. And everything we've been saying so far applies largely to neutral molecules. Now, if you think of a channel sort of like a hole, it may be specific, but it's a hole. If something is neutral, and you put a lot of it on this side, well, it diffuses till it's even. But what if the thing is charged? It makes a big difference. And since most channels are for ions, this is an important issue. And perhaps the easiest way to illustrate this is to give an example. It turns out that almost all cells of the body have what are called potassium leak channels. These are especially important in muscle and nerve, but probably all cells have them. They're called this because they're not gated. They are open all the time. Now, you might say to yourself, what good is a hole that's open all the time? Obviously, things are going to leak out, and it's just going to be you make a hole in the balloon, and there it goes. But that's not the case. Now, because of the sodium-potassium pump, the normal state of affairs is high potassium inside and low potassium relative to the outside. That is, it's higher inside than outside. This pump is running all the time, so this is the basic state of affairs. Now, just for the sake of argument, pretend you turn off the pump. Doesn't really matter, but pretend you turn off the pump. And now you open a channel for potassium. What is going to happen? Obviously, potassium is going to leave because higher concentration here, it's going to go up. Will it leak out until the concentration is the same on both sides? I turned off the pump, remember. Well, remember, it's charged, right? This cell not only has a lot of potassium, but it has anions, too. Things like chloride. What happens when some potassium leaves? If the chloride, the anions can't move, just the potassium. So some potassium comes out, right? Now, that's entirely driven by the chemical gradient. But it's an ion, so we have to worry about electrical charge. If positive ions leave, what's going to happen to the charge difference across this membrane? To begin with, we were neutral. We didn't have any. But now we've lost positives out of this cell, and they've left. So now what the cell is going to look like is it's going to be a little bit minus on the inside relative to the outside. There's an excess of minuses inside relative to the outside. So now, in addition to the chemical gradient, what else do we have? We have an electrical difference. We have a voltage difference. And which way is it going to work on the potassium? Out or in? The potassium is positive, it's negative inside. So the electrical gradient is in, and the chemical gradient is out. Now, therefore, is potassium just going to leak out indefinitely? No. It's going to leak out until these two balance out. Until the chemical push out is balanced by the electrical push in. And it turns out that you reach a balance with only a slight minus on the inside of the cell relative to the outside. These leak channels are thought to be responsible for the fact that cells are slightly negative on the edge relative to the outside. The cell overall is close to neutral, but it's a little excess minus. And the fact that there is a voltage difference across this membrane now provides a kind of tripwire. Because if you disturb it, what's going to happen is that ions are going to flow. If you allow it, ions will flow in response to this voltage change, and that allows you to have muscle and nerve response. That there is already a difference across the membrane which can be exploited. Now we want to say just a word about mechanism, and for that you want to look at the other side of your handout. Now, we're not going to go over this in detail right now, but I want to say what the basic idea is. That when you have carrier-mediated transport, case 3, you have a protein that can face this side, or it can face that side. You can think of it as the revolving door, or what some people call the rocking banana, or you can think of it as a sort of swinging door. But it's pretty obvious that it can allow things to go in either direction. Maybe the revolving door is the easiest. If you have a lot of people on this side, they can go through to this side. You have a lot of people on this side, they go through to that side. If you think of the rocking banana, there's a lot more sodium on this side or glucose on this side. It's going to get caught and pushed to the other side or vice versa. So in fact, this kind of carrier-mediated transport can be used in either direction. Now, what about when you have active co-transport, like for glucose and sodium? Again, you have a protein that has two forms. But the idea is it has two forms, but they can both face in either direction. So if it's in this form and it binds sodium, it grabs glucose and it does this and it flips. Can it do it the other way? Yes. If it's on this side and there's a lot of sodium, grabs glucose, and flips. The point is there are two forms, and either one can face either way. Now, there are many physical models for this, and the one on the bottom of your handout is one of them. The idea that you can, if there is high sodium on this side, then you bind sodium, it binds glucose, and you flip. But on the other side, there's low sodium. So the sodium falls off, the glucose falls off, and you go back. So whichever side has higher sodium binds glucose also and goes to the other side. And then they both fall off, and it goes back. But primary active transport, like for sodium and potassium, is thought to be a little different. It's the same routine that you have two forms of the carrier. But the difference is, the one that faces in is always a different shape from the one that faces out. So when you're facing in, it's one way. If you're facing out, it's the other. And it's ATP that allows you to switch from one to the other. And one form prefers sodium, and one form prefers potassium. So when it's facing outside, and you can see this on the handout, on the top, we've diagrammed what happens with the sodium-potassium pump. And look at that very briefly. There are prettier pictures of this in your book, but they illustrate the same principles. That you have two forms of the enzyme, the one that faces in and the one that faces out. Now, there are two forms for this glucose-sodium co-transporter also, which are conventionally, for reasons unbeknownst to me, called A and B instead of E1 and E2. Now, for the sodium-potassium transporter, antiporter, the idea is the one that's inside has a high affinity for sodium, and the form that faces outside, this is written on your handout, has a high affinity for potassium. So when the enzyme is facing inside, it tends to pick up sodium. And that seems to trigger the ATPase of the enzyme. This kinase is perhaps the right word for it. Kinase activity is part of this complex. It's not a separate enzyme. So this is a complicated protein complex, and it includes both a kinase activity and a phosphatase activity. And it's thought that binding sodium triggers the kinase. That makes the ATP phosphorylate and turn the enzyme around. And you notice we wrote this form as having a phosphate. But once the enzyme is facing out, it's in the other form. It doesn't like sodium anymore. It lets go of it, and it picks up potassium. But the binding of the potassium is thought to activate the phosphatase. So it knocks the phosphate off and turns the enzyme around. And when the enzyme is inside, well, we're back where we started. It doesn't like potassium. So it spits the potassium out into the cytoplasm and picks up sodium. And you just go around and around. Now, this process is micro-reversible. If you have high enough concentrations of ions, you can make it make ATP instead of the reverse. And the enzymes, the ATP synthase in mitochondria, basically does the reverse of this. Instead of using ATP to push ions, it uses ions to make ATP, but it's protons. But inside a cell, this always goes this way. You can't use it to make ions. You can use it to take sodium out and potassium in, but not the reverse. However, with the glucose-sodium cotransporter, you can use it to bring sodium in, glucose in, or glucose out. So we'll talk some more about this next time a little bit and how it's all used in the body to get the glucose you eat into your body cells.